So we're going to get going with Ford Motor. We've got with us today Joe Hinrichs, who is the Group VP of Global Manufacturing and Labor Affairs. I think Joe does the job of, like, what is it, six people now, seven people?
Yeah, downtown.
Joe's in charge of almost everything at Ford. So we're very lucky to have him. Thank you for coming, Joe.
Thank you, Chris. To be clear, Alan's in charge of everything at Ford. But it's great to get a chance to be back here. I was here last year. Oh, did I bump that? I don't know how that happened. I was here last year and spent most of our time, you know, talking about flexible manufacturing and where we were going with that and the leadership position we were taking and taking our global platforms and our global manufacturing flexibility worldwide. And today, I want to talk to you more about, frankly, where we're going with our business and our plans to continue our progress. I think a lot has happened in the year since we were here last year. I don't need to remind everybody of that. Clearly, it's been probably one of the most historic years in the history of our industry. And we still face many challenges. You know, where's the market going? What's happening with all of our competitors? And you know all about these issues as well if you follow our industry. But what's most important, frankly, is to talk about what we're doing, how we're facing those challenges, how we're going to execute our plan, and what we're doing to kind of keep Ford in the driver's seat, if you will, on controlling our own destiny. We can't talk about the progress in our business, though, without talking about our plan. Since Alan Mulally came on board now 3 years ago, we've been a consistent, you know, kind of a constancy of purpose in what our plan is. And it's a four-point plan. It hasn't changed. We've added a few words over the course of time, but really it's pretty simple. Aggressively restructure to operate profitably at the current demand and changing model mix, and that's been changing quite significantly recently, but this goes back several years, so you can see what kind of path we've been on for quite some time. Accelerate the development of new products so customers want value, and we have some success to talk about today on that front. Finance our plan, improve our balance sheet, a very important part of our business, obviously, and working together effectively as one team, leveraging our global assets. One of the big things that's changed in Ford over the last several years is a movement from basically away from multiple entities that were individual businesses around the world to one global business. So we're going to talk about our progress today in the context of this plan. And I'm really going to focus on the first two bullet points mostly, on how we're restructuring we've done, what we're doing about it, and then what we're doing on the product side, which is frankly the heart of our business and most important to what we do. I know you're pretty familiar with the recent history of our company and the aggressive restructuring actions we've taken over the last several years. Frankly, over the last 5 or 6 years in North America and more aggressively worldwide over the last 3 years, including the United States. If you look at what has taken place just over a relatively short period of time, I'm going to start with just what's happened here with the UAW. Obviously, I'm deeply involved in this, but it also sets the stage for other things to come. This is a timeline of kind of major events since 2005 with the UAW here in the United States. Most of our restructuring efforts have focused around North America, and the UAW has been a major part of that. When you look at this slide, though, you see, for example, go back to 2005, when Visteon was having challenges back then, we did a Visteon deal where we took back the really most of the North American plants, or all the UAW plants, and we brought them back into Ford. Two of those plants came back into Ford proper. The rest of them came into what we call ACH, Automotive Components Holdings Group. I'm also responsible for ACH as a business. And we took back 17 plants. To avoid, frankly, losing control of our major supplier that had previously been obviously part of Ford when we spun it off, and to avoid a Delphi-like situation, we're losing control of that, and I think it's been well documented by GM, the billions of dollars that the Delphi situation has cost them. Even back in 2005, we were proactively taking action to avoid losing control of things going on in our business. We also did the first Viva deal. It seemed like a long time ago. It was small in nature, but it was very important because it set forth the sea change of agreements that came after that. And frankly, we led the way on many of the things that are on this page. In 2006, you may recall we did our Way Forward and Way Forward Acceleration announcements where we announced plant closings, restructuring of the business, a refocusing on the product and talking about how we needed to improve our quality of our business, which I'll talk more about later. But we also went plant by plant by plant mid-cycle, so not during the contract period, and asked our UAW local plants in the United States to redo their local agreements to be more competitive. And that's where the subject of what's core and non-core, which led to some later conversations in 2007, really took place. And we started aggressively restructuring. But what was important about that is we went out and communicated very aggressively to our workforce what was needed to change. Because during the same time period, we proactively went out and raised a lot of money, as you recall, or at least raised a lot of debt capacity, as you recall, and we use that as an impetus to go out and talk about why we needed to restructure our business and why this massive loan was needed, but also why it was going to be necessary to change how we did business. We also started our separation programs for the first time system-wide with our UAW employees. In 2007, we did the UAW agreement, as did GM and Chrysler at the national contract level, and that contract was very important for several reasons. It established the entry-level wage rate, which is this you know, different structure of cost for our future hires. It also dealt with the VEBA on a broader scale at that point in time and established the VEBA that we now know. It also had other parts of the agreement that took out some costs, and it set the stage for what was to come. We also had 32,000 UAW employees leave during 2007, all in 1 year, with buyouts. Roughly half of those were people with less than 10 years seniority, or people who weren't retirement eligible, which was very important to move forward with our cost structure. In 2008, we conducted two more buyouts, 7,000 total. In 2009, back in February, when GM and Chrysler were facing a deadline from the U.S. government to meet certain conditions of their operating agreements and their VEBA with the UAW, we reached an agreement with the UAW ourselves, which I'll talk more about later. But we also had another 1,000 employees leave. So 40,000 employees over a three-year time period, basically cutting our workforce roughly in half, while we did three national agreements to ratify and local agreements twice. A lot of activity in a short period of time, historic activity. During that same time period, well, actually a little bit longer than that, since 2003, we closed 18 plants. And we started restructuring back in 2003, and a third of those 18 were assembly plants. We've announced plans to close Cleveland Casting Plant next year. The Wayne Assembly Plant will merge together with Michigan Assembly Plant to become one plant on a site that used to have two plants. So we have two closures next year. And then we've announced plans to close our Indianapolis plant, which is part of ACH, and our Twin Cities Assembly Plant in 2011. So the story here is about a proactive nature in dealing with the cost structure, but also proactive in controlling our own business and moving ourselves forward. And it goes back several years, and all these things add together to lead us forward. If you go to 2009, the February agreement that we reached, well, actually it was ratified in March, but we reached agreement in February, there were several changes made at that point in time, too, which frankly were more, from a wage and economic standpoint, more impactful than the 07 agreement on current wages and benefits. Because I know you've been through this, but just a reminder, there was suspension of COLA, which is cost of living allowance. There were two different bonuses, a lump sum bonus and a Christmas bonus taken away. There were paid incentives for a wellness program on health care. There was a decrease in the number of paid holidays, and all kinds of other things happened in that time period. On the productivity side, we addressed things like skilled trades classifications, work flexibility in implementing different work schedules for alternative means of doing business, and reducing the relief time or the break time people had in our plants. Now, that was a lot, but one of the biggest things that happened, certainly in February, March, was the elimination of the famous jobs bank, which provides much more flexibility to adjust our manpower going forward. And basically, people's supplemental unemployment benefits are now tied to their seniority, and there's a fixed time where they can be excess before they run out of time and they come off the rolls. But they also have to accept jobs elsewhere if they're open, and that creates a far different dynamic in our business than we've had historically, with a fixed set of costs and a fixed location, no matter what happened in our business. The savings related with all of this were announced back in the spring, and you know, I think we had a number around $500 million a year plus the VEBA part. But it gets back to the heart and soul of what we've been trying to accomplish the last several years. On multiple occasions, whether it was raising the debt capacity back in 06, doing the Visteon ACH deal in 05, or proactively working with our union partners to do the union contracts over the last several years, a way to go about moving forward, of saving money to control our own destiny. And the savings related to these areas really get plowed back into the products, which we'll talk more about in a second. And that's the heart and soul of the Ford Motor Company. So as a result, we were able to reaffirm our product commitments that we made in 07 and 09 with the UAW about investing in our business here while we've been reducing capacity to better rationalize capacity and demand to make more products that people want, including retooling truck plants to make cars and other things like that that we've announced. And even our Michigan assembly plant next year will launch a global C car. At the same time all that was going on, we renegotiated the VEBA, allowing for us the option to do 50% of the VEBA going forward as payments in stock. At the time, the first three payments were fixed and the rest of them were 30 days weighted market average prices, volume market average prices. But then we came back subsequently, recently, and got an agreement to have all the payments if we choose to be at the market average for 30 days. So very good progress and a lot to do. Now, what does all that mean? This is what's happened to our hourly employment in the U.S. for our Ford and ACH. This is UAW employment. Dramatic workforce reductions really have taken place in the last few years. And it illustrates the progression of what's taken place in our business and obviously the massive restructuring that's gone on. But through our involuntary programs, we've taken out 40,000 employees through that since 2006 and had about 41,000 employees at the end of July in 2009, to put it all in perspective. And the reductions allowed us to increase our manufacturing efficiency, obviously, and our flexibility, taking an enormous fixed cost, which was fixed before with the union contracts, out of our business, and better allowed us to align capacity and demand and diminish the pressure to build units that we didn't need, which will pay off later when we talk about what's happening with our pricing and our products. These also were a significant contribution to our overall structural cost reductions, and I think we've announced that today we're on pace to reduce our structural cost by $14 to $15 billion globally compared to where we were in 2005. That's a huge number. Now, while all this was going on, interestingly, we went from middle of the pack to first place in quality while we took out half our workforce and closed a third of our assembly plants, which is amazing testament to the talent, the capability of the people in our organization. Today, our quality ranks top of the industry. It's statistically tied with Toyota, but the lowest TDWs of the industry here in North America on the Ford Lincoln Mercury brand. And it's the first time we beat Toyota. You can see the chart. And now we're statistically ahead of GM and Honda. And we've had this study going on since 1981. And it's the first time that we've had this happen. So it's a key signal to what we're doing is paying off in the initial quality of our vehicles. We're seeing, you know, 70% of our vehicles are recommended buys by Consumer Reports. We're seeing J.D. Power awards and appeals and other things in IQS. F-150 was the only vehicle to win IQS for J.D. Power and the appeal award in the industry. So there's a lot of great things happening. All this happening, though, while we went through that massive restructuring, which is really important for the future because it sets up our brand and our business going forward. Everyone asks this question, so I might as well address it now. Where are we with the UAW, with Ford? It's no secret that we've been sitting down with them to discuss our additional contract modifications based on what took place with GM and Chrysler. It's very important to note the vast majority of the contract changes that took place at GM and Chrysler were basically patterned off of what we did in February. So in the near term, there is no cost disadvantage or competitive disadvantage to us versus GM and Chrysler, economic or otherwise. However, there are items we're working on and discussing with the UAW that are key areas for what we believe in our current agreement differ from GM and Chrysler in areas that could affect us longer term. There's been plenty of media reports and speculation about what those are. For us to get into them today because we're currently in the middle of discussions. So I'm not going to go into detail, but suffice to say that as you've seen over time, we have a long, proud history of working with the UAW over the last several years in a proactive manner to continue to reduce our costs and keep ourselves competitive, and in most cases, out front of what others are doing, and we intend to keep doing that. We also opened up contract discussions with the CAW on Tuesday of this week, and we're similarly working closely with them to align our cost structure there with what's happening with our competitors in Canada. We'll have more details to talk about both of those at the right time and a replace in the process. all these reductions and all these things set forth the ability to talk about what's really exciting to talk about, and that's a laser focus on the Ford global brand around the world and on our products. All the progress we've made on cost and the progress we've made as a business have allowed us to focus ourselves worldwide on the Ford brand and Lincoln Mercury here in North America. And it's all about accelerating the development of new products that people want and value, which was on that original slide for the 4 points of our plan. We're doing this a number of key ways. First off, you can see we reduced our brand portfolio, Land Rover, Jaguar, Aston Martin. We've divested some of our interest in Mazda. And, of course, we have Volvo held for sale. In the process, we're also clarifying with our global platforms what we're doing with the Ford brand worldwide. I'll talk more about that in a second, which has allowed us to reduce the number of nameplates from 2006 to 2008 from 97 to 59, and significant further reductions coming as we move forward. We're efficiently developing a world-class engineering organization that allow us to develop a world-class portfolio of small, medium, and large cars, trucks, and utilities and crossovers that are uniquely global for Ford. And because Ford is so unique, we can do this on a global scale, unlike most of our competitors, because we have one brand worldwide. We're committed to producing a balanced portfolio of vehicles. This is where we looked at in the U.S., where we looked in 2005. 59% of our volume for sales was for trucks and SUVs, SUVs being body-on-frame, Explorer, Expedition, those kind of vehicles, and 32% cars and 9% crossovers. In 2008, we were down to 46% trucks and SUVs, 35% cars, and 19% crossovers. See the significant growth in crossovers. Our projections for 2011 will be 39% trucks and SUVs, 38% cars, and 23% crossovers. Much more balance. Now, I get the question all the time, yeah, but you still have more trucks and SUVs, and that's because, frankly, we have such a strong showing there and don't intend to give it up. We have roughly 30% market share in trucks and don't want to give that up. And while that segment shrinks a little bit, we still have a strong presence there. But the key is the growth in the car segment and the crossover segment. We began that by implementing our car strategies in 2007 and 8, and then more recently, the Edge and the Flex crossovers, and the success of our Escape. And by 2011, you'll see that roughly 60% of our product line here in U.S. sales will be on cars and crossovers. Now, how do we do that? I get that question all the time. How do you make money doing that? On our global cycle plan, in 2009, we had 345,000 units per core platform. And by 2014, that will nearly double to 680,000, a 97% improvement. Just to give you some facts, how are we leveraging our economies of scale? By 2012, 78% of Ford's global volume will be on core platforms, up from 29% in 2007. In the next 5 years, we'll roughly double our capacity, our volume per core platform. By 2013, all Ford vehicles competing in global segments will be common in North America, Europe, and Asia. And those core platforms obviously are critical to us to get the cost base down with our supply base and our manufacturing base to be able to compete. Now, what's that look like? On global products, let's start with the B segment and how the One Ford product plan is playing out. In the past, we sold Fiestas in South America and Europe and Asia. They looked nearly identical, but weren't exactly the same. We're separately engineered and shared very few parts. All right. The new Fiesta, which will be common around the world, which there's a picture of it, will be tailored to individual markets to meet certain requirements, but yet be the same platform and the same vehicle pretty much around the world. Now, that Fiesta that we're talking about here, we're already in place, and in fact, through the end of June, at the end of June, it was Europe's number two best-selling car. It was launched last fall. It's essentially sold out this year in Europe. And we just launched it in Asia, in China, and we're very pleased with the initial response we're getting in Asia, and actually it's exceeding our expectations. That car, of course, comes to North America in the first half of next year, being built down in Mexico in our retooled Cuautitlan assembly plant, which was a truck plant, now being retooled to produce the Fiesta. So that's what it looks like. Now, same thing on the Focus. In North America, we have a Focus that's been selling really well. Here in North America, as you know, was one of the winners in the Cash for Clunkers sales as well. But we have a different Focus on a different platform, different engineering, different design, very few shared parts for Europe, South America, and Asia Pacific. Next year, we'll be launching a global focus. Can't show you the picture yet. But trust me, it's an exciting product. And from the very beginning of the product development process, it was conceived and designed as a car to be sold on all the markets around the world. It's great to look at, fun to drive, like our characteristics of our vehicles that we have in Europe on the driving dynamics, and packed with all kinds of technologies and creature comforts. Because one of the things that we're seeing, especially in the North American market, as people are downsizing in vehicles, they still want the technology and the extra features that they're used to in their bigger vehicles, which helps with the revenue stream on smaller vehicles. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to build that vehicle in our Michigan assembly plant, which is a retooling of a Michigan truck plant, which used to make the Expedition Navigator. I talked about that last year, to be able to launch it here in North America. And we've also announced we're going to build a battery electric version of that global focus right in Michigan for the North American market in 2011. In the coming years, there's the North American Fusion. Great product, been selling really well for us this year. And the European designed Mondeo, which is also sold in Asia Pacific. Very successful product in both markets, but yet different, as you can tell, but same size. And that will come on a single global platform. And we won't stop there. As I talked about, the other global products in the global cycle, in the global segments, will move to one product, and we'll not have those announcements at the appropriate time down the road. Now, how do you do all this? And how do you afford it? And how do you make it all make sense? To facilitate our ability to deliver these global products efficiently, we've been moving on a global scale, led by Derek Kuzak in our product development world in our business around the world. And we've achieved substantial and continuous improvement in our engineering and investment efficiencies. You can see the numbers there. By reducing vehicle platforms, by reducing number of engine families, transmissions, and the order complexity of our vehicles, very important. As an example, orderable combinations have been reduced by 90% from the 2008 model year to 2009 model year. An additional 56% from 2009 model year to 2010 model year. That saves a lot of money from an engineering and test and supply-based capacity standpoint. And we're going through a rigorous process of deleting parts that are frankly called at very low take rates. Because of our global perspective and our improved processes, our engineering costs, new vehicle engineering costs on a global scale, reduced by 60% since 2005-2008, and we're seeing continuous improvement moving forward. And further efficiencies will come as we continue to implement our global platform strategy. At the same time, very importantly, our new vehicle facilities and tooling investments are reduced by 40%, and then we'll see those decreases coming further on an ongoing basis as well. On the cycle plan front, I think there's been a lot written recently about the competitiveness of the Ford portfolio here in North America and around the globe, and that progress is not going to slow down. We're committed to reducing the average age of our product portfolio. By 2014, we will have lowered the average age of our global product portfolio by a further 20% from where we are in 2009, which we believe will put us in the right place competitively with the best in the industry. Here's what we've done just in the last 2 years in just the U.S. market. We replaced or refreshed 45% of our volume, or our vehicle portfolio by volume in the U.S. lineup, and it's now the freshest lineup we've ever had in the United States. And you'll recognize some of those names: Mustang, Taurus, F-150, Fusion, the Flex, and the Lincoln products, and in the recent importation of the Transit Connect. 45% of the volume here in just the last 2 years. When it all comes down to it, how do people respond to your products? Because we've been trying so hard to maintain our product portfolio and investments. And this is saying our customers are satisfied, and they're leading to improved revenues. This is very important for our business. As we sell more highly equipped, globally designed vehicles with reduced incentives, the benefit of delivering these great products our customers want value is right here. In the first half of 2009 alone, net pricing improvement boosted our bottom line by nearly $2 billion. Net pricing. And Ford's focus on matching capacity and demand and keeping our inventory levels down and disciplined is a big contributor to this, as well as our ability to launch great style new vehicles that people want. Now, I showed you that chart on the left in the last 2 years. That's the baseline from where we go from here. And globally,
All of our new vehicle and major refresh products compared to 2009 look like this. 70-90% improvement globally based on 2009 base. Another 140-160% improvement from 2014 versus 2009. Next year we're launching the Global Fiesta in North America. We're launching the Global Focus around the world. We talked about a new Explorer next year. We have a battery electric Transit Connect next year. A Ford engineered diesel going into our Super Duty trucks. And much more, all happening off of a base that's already pretty competitive. Now looking forward, that 70-90% refresh rate on our product lineups in North America, Europe, South America, and Asia Pacific, by volume by 2012, means we almost refresh in, on average, the whole product portfolio in the next 3 years based on the 2009 baseline. And then we do it almost another time again by 2014. That's what's happening with the product portfolio in our business. That means within 5 years, we'll have fully refreshed our product portfolio and be about halfway towards doing it again. And that's critically important on the product side. What does that mean? Obviously, ultimately, the customers are the ones who determine whether or not we're winners or losers, and that's based on what pricing you get and what market share you get, right? And this is what's been happening. In our two major markets, the United States and Europe, you can see 2008, the market share is 14.2 and 8.6 respectively. In 2009, August year to date, for U.S. is 15.1, and that number for Europe is actually July year to date. We don't have the August numbers out yet at 9.1. So you can see, starting to see a trend of increasing market share. We're solidly number two in Europe, as many of you know, and we're very pleased with the progress we're seeing. And so in the U.S. in July and August, we saw year-over-year sales gains for the first time since November 2007. And in 10 of the last 11 months in the U.S. on the retail side, we've gained market share. So a good trend here, and obviously both Europe and the United States part of that. And in the second quarter, we actually also grew share in South America and Asia Pacific and Africa. So in the second quarter of this year, we actually grew share in all the four major regions of the world. At the end of the day, it's all about having a cost structure and having a product development process and products that people want and value, and having it set up in a way where we stick true to our core beliefs and our core strategy. I can put the four-point plan back up here again. It's all about restructuring to current demand and having capacity that matches what's really out there, accelerating new products, financing the plan, which has been a very important part of the Ford story the last several years, improving the balance sheet, and working together as one global team. We still face numerous challenges. No one in the world thinks that we're anywhere near done. But great progress and momentum in an environment that's been very challenging and frankly historic from an industry perspective. And we look forward to sharing with you the progress that we have in the years to come. Thanks. Oh, I have to do the safe harbor. Can you read that?
I memorized it, Joe.
Yeah.
All right, I got a lot of questions for you. I guess the one that I would start with, and I've had a lot of discussions with a number of investors over the past year, at least, and one of the things that I think is a critical area to study right now is, given the changes in the mix of your business, all the costs you've taken out, changes in the labor force, the improvement in the product, let's think about profitability. And let's talk in terms of an EBITDA margin, for example.
Mm-hmm.
From, let's say, 01 to 08, the average EBITDA margin for the company was about 4%. If I go back further and I look from, say, 91 to 08, the average is about 6%. You had a period in there in the late 90s, early 2000s, when
yep.
you were pumping out Explorers and you did 10 or 11%.
Mm-hmm.
So how do I think about all of these changes that you've made in the business? On the one hand, all the cost savings. The other hand, maybe a shift toward cars away from trucks. And what should we look at going forward? Is it going to be closer to the 4% from your recent history, closer to the 6% for your long-run average,
mm-hmm.
or can you get back to a peak margin of like a 10%?
Well, it is a great question. Clearly, we're not going to give any guidance on where we think our EBITDA is going. But I would look at it this way, because you're right. I mean, when you think about the late 90s, and really we peaked in 2000 in North America, and frankly the U.S., we were frankly determined, we were dependent upon really two things, the U.S. market and
trucks and SUVs. And now I would look at it differently and say, from a global perspective, our business is much more balanced in the ability to compete globally. We've had profits in South America and Europe, you know, now we've had obviously some changes recently in Europe with the volumes, but the second quarter was an improvement. But you look at Europe and South America, they've been profitable. North America's been on a nice improvement trend. And our Asia-Pacific operations aren't as sizable as certainly Europe and North America, but improving nonetheless and growing. So you have to look at our business on a global scale now, not so much on so North American-centric, although certainly North America is a dominant piece of our business. And the portfolio effect is significant. But the fixed cost structure reductions that we talked about, the $14, $15 billion, those are real. And they're spread out across the business, but they're when you saw the progress that we had in the 90s, which were mostly North American driven, they weren't fixed cost driven. They were, you know, not until in the mid 90s, they were market share and margin driven. And so when you look at where we are today, we know we can compete on the car segments. We know how to do it on a global scale. We're getting much more efficient across our operations. So it is a different Ford today than it was trying to analyze it 10 years ago. I think you have to think of it that way. I think it's very important and telling that our brand, our corporate brand is improving, as evidenced by our pricing and our market share, and our products are improving. So you have to do some assessment of how valuable you think that is and how sustainable you think that is. Clearly, we feel very confident in our investment levels, what we're going to do on product to stay fresh and competitive over the next several years. And that's one of the differentiators today, the number of launches that we have in 2009, 2010 compared to some of our competitors. And that's going to sustain itself in our product plan as we speak. So I think those are the ways to look at it. It's a different cost structure than we had even back when we were making all that money. And importantly, we still have Ford Credit. And as part of our enterprise and as a key corporate asset and part of our business. And so I think you can't forget how important Ford Credit is to our business as well.
Maybe one more before I open it up to the floor. One of the other key variables that comes up in discussions with investors is, and keeping in mind, I know you just talked about how much more global Ford is than it used to be, but a key variable for people is the U.S. market share.
Sure.
You've seen some improvement there recently. You mentioned 10 out of the last 11 months you've had improvement at retail. Is there a ceiling here, given how many competitive players there are in the market? Now, how high can you take it? What's a reasonable number to think about?
Yeah, it's a great question. If I knew that answer, I knew the industry answer, I could plan a lot better for the next year. What we're seeing happen this year in the U.S. marketplace, clearly we've had some success with our new products and with our business. The Koreans have had significant success in market share this year, mostly on the cost side, you know, competing on price and cost. And you've seen, obviously, some market share losses in our domestic competitors. The key question is, I think, how much of that is the result of new products, which we've had a lot of and we will have a lot more in the next year, versus our competitors? How much of that is continuing recognition that Ford is running its business on its own and getting some, you know, people responding to that? And what does that look like over time? And the recognition of our improved quality and the improvements in our competitiveness of our new products on fuel economy, styling, technology, other things. There's a lot of dynamics at play. And so what we're watching very closely is the combination of not just market share, but pricing and market share. Because clearly we need margin improvement to keep improving our business, and we're seeing it. So that's what's important to watch, are both those in concert together. We could go after more market share and not cut our, you know, and not be as disciplined as we have been on inventories and incentives, but we think that, you know, it's always a fine balance, but we think that they're all contributing together to provide a bit of momentum. And balancing that is, you know, a billion-dollar question. But so I don't think it's just market share. I think it's what kind of pricing do we get for our new products and for the Ford brand itself with all the things that we've talked about. Let me answer it this way, because you know there's so many different, you know, healthcare is handled differently, and you know pensions are different, etc. From an assembly plant cost and labor and overhead and those kinds of things, we're pretty actually comparable, and in U.S. dollars, a little bit less in North America than we are in Europe now. And the U.S. dollar is weakened a little bit, so you got to, you know, keep all that in perspective. But we've made tremendous progress in North America, and frankly, the last 2 years, we've had double-digit efficiency improvements in our manufacturing operations year over year, which are double the historic rates we used to have, facilitated by the buyouts, but not just the buyouts, and this whole how we do our business together locally. We feel very confident that we're very competitive in Europe. When you look at data, like we get a private harbor report in Europe and other things, we feel very confident that we're in very competitive shape in Europe, and we're on most parts of our business approaching those levels here in North America, with more to come with what's going on with our continued rationalization and getting some more volume back. So we're pretty comfortable. Our Asian operations have been launching and have been expanding over there, and they're doing well. And our South American operations in the last year especially have really made some improvements on the manufacturing front. So pretty comfortable that we're getting into a very competitive space globally on our manufacturing costs. We have some legacy issues here in the U.S. with pensions and with the VEBA, although the VEBA model that we have works for us, and now the option to do 50% equity certainly has made that a much more attractive opportunity for us. But generally speaking, on the assembly side, vehicle assembly side, we're pretty competitive worldwide no matter where we are. Engines, there's still more room for opportunity in North America, primarily because of capacity and overcapacity on the V8 side and those kinds of things. Transmissions were pretty competitive in North America. Stampings, competitively globally, and a little more room to do in North America because we have a legacy of all the standalone stamping plants, which is a little bit of a challenge. But we feel pretty confident that we've gotten to a space now where manufacturing is not a problem for us from a cost competitiveness standpoint. You lead it. Thanks.
Breakdown of the cost.
I could give some directional estimates, but I prefer not to, the material obviously is the dominant share of the percentage, so how you
65-60% for material,
a little more than that, when you look at the cost of the vehicle. And so that's where, obviously, how we design the vehicles, how we get that global scale, why it has such a big impact. And, you know, the manufacturing costs, it depends on what you include. Do you include legacy or not? You know, is it variable fixed piece of it, and et cetera? That's why I prefer not to get in numbers, because I can make the numbers look different depending on what part you include. But, you know, at the end of the day, it really comes down to your material cost of the design, the quality, because there's a significant cost over time of warranty and quality. These aren't in order. Manufacturing, clearly, and your fixed cost base, excluding manufacturing. And then the incentives you have to put on the marketing and both fixed marketing and variable marketing. And those are the basics. The engineering isn't, you know, what we spend on engineering worldwide is important, but it's less than we spend on CapEx. So, you know, I think it's all proportional. Thanks.
Nelson? So the global concept, you kind of tried in the 90s, as I remember, and it didn't really work. So why is it going to work this time around?
It's a great question. We had the famous Ford Contour and Mercury Mystique, which were CD-sized vehicles that were engineered in Europe and then brought here and sold and didn't do as well as we'd like them to do. I wasn't with Ford at the time, but I know the story.
Don't blame Joe.
No, I was at General Motors at the time. You can probably blame me for other things. The difference is this, number one. First of all, we started with establishing a global organization, and that followed, not led, what happened in the 90s. And we truly have a global Ford organization. I mean, it's not one person's idea, or it's not an org chart. It's real. I mean, Derek Kuzak runs product development worldwide, and there's no question of that. And so, but we also, the other important part is we had a product that was designed for Europe and for Europe tastes, and then we brought it to the U.S. On the Focus, it's being designed from the day one with the intention of being sold globally. So when we have design reviews and when we do market tests, when we go out and test the design, the styling, and we do all these things, we're doing them in multiple regions with input and feedback from customers in all the different regions. And doing it at a cost structure that can be supported in all these different regions. That's a very different process than what took place in the 90s. The second thing is, we have a vastly better cost structure today than we had then, as far as our fixed costs, and then also, frankly, for North America, our ability to manufacture here at a different cost level. Because, I mean, you know, we have a very different proposition today on what it costs to build something here in the U.S. now than what it cost 10, 15 years ago. So if you talk about just the U.S. market. And I think the other thing is what's happened, and this is very important, because what's happened is the invention of the internet and the global nature of communication and information is such that people know about products around the world and they want the best of what's available around the world. Consumers are much more accepting of global products than they were in the past. If you go back to the Contour Mystique example, so the biggest feedback we got was the rear seat room was too small for North American tastes. Well, I guarantee you that won't be the case with the Mondeo and the Fusion when they come together. Now the Mondeo is bigger today than the Contour Mystique was for that same segment back then. So what we've also seen is the Taurus has gotten bigger. We've seen emerging of what people want. We used to talk about, in America, all they want in small cars is cheap. Well, in Europe, small car was the heart of the segments, and they wanted features and great paint colors and all those things. Well, that's now true everywhere. And so that merging of tastes and interests allows us to be able to do these things on a scale that we weren't able to do before, which is exciting for us because, frankly, like maybe one or two other companies, we can use the Ford brand now globally, which was established worldwide, for those products and not have to tweak them and change them for different brands and whatnot. So that's an exciting uniqueness, maybe not unique only to Ford, but one of the opportunities that Ford has versus some other competitors to do.
I assume the expectation is that the Fiesta will be profitable in North America.
Yeah. We don't take products programs to the board of directors that aren't profitable. That's a short conversation.
The BMW Mini, does that change your thought about how you design and market small cars more, or is that similar to the niche product?
Well, it is a niche product, but I think it does allow for a recognition that people will pay for and willing to pay the higher revenue for a small car that is stylish or has a value proposition that's different than just, you know, value per se, and are willing to pay for that. And as we saw last summer, spring and summer, when fuel prices were $4 a gallon, the American consumer's taste changed pretty dramatically when it came to, and then you gave them a little incentive recently, and their mix changed a lot, too, with the cash for clunkers. And we have taken a position that certainly we expect gas prices over time to increase. So all that's coming together to allow for a better proposition for smaller vehicles, and now a better proposition for globally designed vehicles in the marketplace. And the Fiesta is a great example. I mean, I took the Fiesta home a couple weeks ago I drive a Lincoln Navigator, which is a big vehicle. I have two teenagers and three kids. And
you put the Fiesta in the back?
Yeah. I took it home that way. The Fiesta, and I get the privilege to drive our vehicles and competitive vehicles, and Fiesta is one of the most fun vehicles I've driven, and it's a B car. I tell you, when people get in, it's styled nice. That's why it's a hit everywhere we have it. It's styled nice, but equally important, it's fun to drive for a B car. B cars 15 years ago weren't fun to drive. At least my memory is that way. It's a great question, though, and it's very important. It gets to part of Chris's question, too, which is, you know, where are your margins going to be when this portfolio rebalances? And it's been happening as we speak, though. You know, while we've seen progress, we've been rebalancing our North American portfolio with more cars and fewer trucks and SUVs because of the marketplace.
Let me get
the best.
Obviously, you know, Ford was very proactive earlier in that game going on in that market. But now with restructuring the enterprise, we've got the highest level of the industry. Also, does that impact the closing of the R&D and keep up the closing?
Well, you know, one of our 4 points, it says finance the plan and, you know, repair the balance sheet and improve the balance sheet. So obviously it's pretty high on our agenda. Now we just did the $10 billion debt restructuring in the spring, and we also raised equity in the spring, as you know, and we also have the Viva deal. So I think we've been pretty active on that front recently. It's an important part of the needs of our business going forward. It does not inhibit us from having a competitive product lineup and investments in product going forward, which is why I showed from the slides I showed, because we're committed to keeping, you know, one of the freshest lineups in the industry and committed to keeping that development in product, because that's frankly part of the success we've had recently. Was we went through this difficult period over the last several years, but sustained ourselves on the product side, and all these new launches are paying off, and you'll see more of that next year, hopefully. So we are definitely committed, and we have the liquidity to keep our funding levels where we need them to be on the product development side, on the cycle plan side for our products. Now, importantly, part of that is because we've taken massive efficiencies in our ability to deliver those new products. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to sustain. So you have those two things going on. And we've kept that in the forefront. When we meet, we talk about how do we fund that cycle plan that we want. And we start there, and then we work on what we have to do on everything else. Now, clearly, the balance sheet's important to us. You've seen actions, and, you know, I'm not going to disclose anything, but obviously it's an important priority for us moving forward. We recognize where we are relative to others. You know, bankruptcy, the outcome of bankruptcy is a restructured balance sheet. So we shouldn't be surprised by what took place. We could be surprised by how it happened, but not the outcome of it when you come out the other side. There's been a proactive nature to Ford, which is part of the theme that I wanted to talk about today, that I think is very important. And it's not just the went-out $23 billion home improvement loan in 2006. It's the recognizing Visteon was going to be a challenge and not letting it get out of control and taking it back in. That was 05. It was doing 32,000 buyouts in late 2006, 2007, certainly before all this hit in the last year. And, you know, I think that's the nature of who we are and what we're about now, and I think you'll continue to see that continue aggressively because it's important to our business.
As a tack on to that, at lunch yesterday we polled the audience. We had about 200 people at lunch, mostly automotive investors across the capital structure, and we asked yes or no, do you think Ford needs to sell equity to delever? You want to guess how many percent said yes?
80%.
Damn, you're good. 82. This is why he's got such a big job. Nice work.
Well, I mean, we need to maintain value for our shareholders at the same time improve our business and our balance sheet. So obviously we recognize the challenges. But, you know, but little things that aren't so little. When we did the Viva deal in February, I mean, I was there and negotiating it. And at the time, over the weekend, our stock had bottomed at 154. I remember it. It closed at 158 or thereabouts.
It's $1.54, not 150.
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. And we did the deal and said, you know, we wanted to at least have some a fixed price for the first couple rounds of options to pay on the Viva
is one, we anticipate we're going to do the debt restructuring, and people want to have some predictability on how many shares are going to be out there. And two, you know, we wanted to pump up the value of the stock a little bit, at least signaling that it's going to be, that UAW believes it's going to be worth something. And, which was, you know, a 30% or plus premium from where it was trading at the day. We thought we did a pretty good job. But we came back and said, you know, obviously the stock appreciated significantly since then. But we sat down with the UAW and said, you know, look at this situation. We're not going to give you stock at $2 a share, $600 million, you know, dollars of stock at $2 a share. It's not, you know, we could either pay you cash, but that means, you know, we want to keep funding everything that's in all of our interest, or we could go raise out, we could go raise equity a different way, which has cost to it and other things. Or why don't we just sit down and figure out how to do the volume weighted average on the 30 days like we have on all the other payments, and it's in your interest too, and here's how it's in your interest. And we worked that out together, quietly, not a lot of fanfare, but that's $1.8 billion, first three payments. So, but that was in our plan at $2, $2.10, and $2.20 back in, you know, the spring before the stock price really started appreciating. So there's a lot of things that are happening all the time to continue to improve our business structure, and clearly it starts with operating profits on the automotive business that we've committed to in 2011. That plays a significant role in our ability to do things in the future. And we've been focused on what we do to repair the balance sheet, but also how do we get back to an investment grade. It's very important for our business, for both Ford Credit and for the motor company. So it's on our radar screen.
I have one more balance sheet question.
Okay.
And we'll cut you off. I'm sorry. We're going long.
I'm the manufacturing labor guy, you know.
Well, this is a labor question. Really.
Okay.
Do you think GM and Chrysler really missed an opportunity by not addressing the pension while they went through bankruptcy? The VIVA you had already done collectively, but it would seem if there's one remaining big volatility source of risk on the balance sheet for all of you guys, it's the pension. You know, sometimes it looks okay, funding's okay. Other times it's a big problem.
Yeah, and returns get better and discount rate goes down and they end up sometimes in the same spot. It's an issue. We think we understand it, and was it an opportunity missed? I mean, that's someone else's question to answer, I think.
Is pension off the table, period, forever?
Well, I don't know if anything's off the table forever, and anyone would say that, but clearly we're not talking about pensions right now. And I think there was a balancing act that took place between dealing with the healthcare trust and the VIBA and the changes that took place with GM and Chrysler in that regard, and then what was going to happen with the pensions. And you're right. I mean, we went in a situation in 2007, going into 2007 negotiations, where GM had a overfunded pension, and they went first and gave increases to the base rate and lump sums, which at Ford we were not real excited about. But, you know, the economics typically are pattern, and that's the way it played out. So I think, though, on balance, when you look at what's taking place, you know, we know the pension levels, we understand them, and we'll manage it as part of our whole balance sheet equation moving forward.
I appreciate you taking all the time.
Thanks, everybody.